Now we're going to go on to our next guest, Will.
That's right, our next guest is Noam Chomsky, Institute Emeritus Professor of Linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's written and spoken extensively on our topic today, including Peace in the Middle East, which was recently republished as Middle East Illusions, The Fateful Triangle, and his latest, just out from Metropolitan Books, Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. Professor Noam Chomsky, thank you for joining us again at KBOO.
Glad to be with you.
Well, we're going to turn back now from looking at the situation in Iraq to the Lebanon conflict and more broadly the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I wonder if we could start with the speculation on the reasons for this latest Israeli war on Lebanon. What we've seen is actually early on different speculation from people like Ilan Pappe, who focused on a kind of a militarism that has conditioned decision-making in Israel, that is driving them towards a more of a conventional war kind of conflict rather than the so-called low-intensity warfare of the occupation, to thoughts by Tanya Reinhart that this has to do with the desire for a greater Israel pushing up to the Litani River, and then, of course, Seymour Hersh's latest piece that outlined how this coupled in with U.S. planning. I wonder, what is your speculation on the reasons, the reasons that underlie this latest war?
Well, the crucial word is speculation. Governments typically regard their own populations as their worst enemy and make sure to try to keep what they're doing secret from the populations. But anyone who's ever looked at the declassified record knows that the security issues are mostly security of the government from the population. Right now, we can only speculate. My own speculation is similar to the ones you cited, but a little bit different. I think the core issue is, as it has been for a long time, Israel-Palestine. The United States and Israel are currently implementing long-standing programs to, with the intent of eliminating any hope of realizing the international consensus on a two-state settlement, or in fact any serious meaningful recognition of Palestinian national rights. That's true in rhetoric, but more important, it's true in implementation. So Gaza has been turned into what Israeli human rights groups call the world's largest prison after it's been devastated by decades of occupation and is almost unlivable. In the West Bank, the official term for the policy is convergence, and it's described in the media here as a courageous program of withdrawal. In fact, it's a program of annexation of valuable land and the most valuable resources, particularly water, combined with infrastructure and settlement programs designed to cantonize the shrinking Palestinian territories, to break them into unviable cantons, pretty much isolated from one another and from whatever pathetic little corner of Jerusalem will be left to Palestinians, the center of their commercial educational, cultural life, to be basically eliminated, all of it to be imprisoned as Israel takes over the Jordan Valley. And you take a look at a map, you can see what all of this means. All of this is totally illegal in violation of numerous Security Council resolutions, even the recently the unanimous agreement of the World Court, including the U.S. Justice, that the settlements are illegal and that any part of the separation wall that incorporates them is, as he put it, de facto illegal in violation of international law. But the U.S. has declared itself openly to be an outlaw state that is not subject to international law and agreements. So therefore this continues, and the you know, the description here, as I said, is that it's courageous withdrawal. Well, there's only one meaningful source of support for the Palestinians who are facing national destruction. That support is from Hezbollah in Lebanon. So it follows that Hezbollah has to be destroyed. The Hezbollah, however, is integrated completely into Lebanese society. So to destroy Hezbollah, you've got to destroy a lot of Lebanon. A side benefit of the destruction of a lot of Lebanon is that it does, here Shai Hirsch's point comes to play, it does, they hope, at least it eliminates or at least reduces a Lebanese-based deterrent to an eventual attack on Iran, if that's ever decided on. I'm skeptical about it. But if they decide, yeah, then it does eliminate a deterrent. But in general, the invasion, which was intended to, and didn't succeed, in fact, but it intended to establish more firmly a U.S. domination of the region and the specific domination of Washington's regional client, by now almost an offshore military base and high-tech center of the United States, with a very powerful army, which, however, was held at bay. The end result of this, it's obvious even from the press, is to have greatly increased the prestige and popularity of Hezbollah, of Nasrallah in particular, throughout the Arab world, Muslim world as well, and in Lebanon as well, with just overwhelming support for him now, which didn't exist before. And it is also creating, and Washington knows this, new generations of radical Islamist jihadi terrorists, but that's a minor consideration for them. The pretext for the invasion was outrage over capture of two Israeli soldiers. And that's considered an intolerable outrage, and we therefore have to respond with massive destruction. That's just pure cynical fraud. I mean, there's been no reaction to many years of Israeli practice of kidnapping Lebanese, leaving them for decades in Israeli prisons, sometimes in secret prisons where nobody knows how many there are. No one ever suggested that just would have justified a massive attack on Israel or even any attack. Now, furthermore, all of this is heightened dramatically by what happened in late June. I mean, the current upsurge of violence began after the capture of an Israeli soldier by Palestinian militants, Gilad Shalit, right across the Gaza-Israel border. Well, that also elicited great outrage and a major Israeli escalation of its attack against Gaza. You can see it by the casualty figures. There were 36 Palestinians killed in June, and that number quadrupled to over 170 in July. But that was considered completely justified because of that outrageous capture of an Israeli soldier on June 25th. Well, on June 24th, one day earlier, Israel carried out a much worse crime. It kidnapped two Gaza civilians and abducted them to Israel, where they entered the prison system and joined the roughly 1,000 others who were in prison without charge, that is, kidnapped. Well, kidnapping of civilians is a far worse crime than capture of a soldier. And it's not that it was unknown. I mean, if you look at the U.S. press, you can find occasional dismissive mention of the fact. But it's considered insignificant, just as the kidnapping of Lebanese over decades has been considered insignificant. What that shows with just dramatic clarity is that the posture of outrage is sheer cynical fraud. There is no justification whatsoever, either for the escalation in of atrocities in Gaza or for the invasion of Lebanon or for any support for it. And I suppose, I suspect that the reason why the kidnapping of on June 24th, the Muammar brothers on June 24th, the reason why that's been basically concealed, and there's no mention of it, although you can find it with a search, is because it's just too embarrassing. It undercuts the entire basis for support for these latest U.S.-Israeli invasion. But I think, to go back to your question, that the motive was to undercut the threat that there might be a political settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict along the lines of the long-standing international consensus that the U.S. has been unilaterally blocking for over 30 years. In this respect, I think the invasion is very much like the 1982 invasion, the worst of the five Israeli invasions. In 1982, Israel invaded, devastated, killed maybe 20,000 people, devastated much of Lebanon. And it was openly recognized at the time within Israel. Here there's all kind of fanciful tales. But within Israel, it was recognized quite openly that this is what they called a war for the West Bank. Its goal is to undercut increasingly embarrassing Palestinian offers for negotiations for a diplomatic settlement, which would mean a two-state settlement, what the world has been supporting. So they invaded Lebanon, drove out the PLO, and put an end to those threats, the threat of a peaceful settlement. And I think this invasion is somewhat similar.
Noam, good morning. This is Hala Goras. We'll get back to the current debacle, the Israeli debacle in Lebanon and what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza. I would like for our listeners to hear about what started all of this, going back to 1948 and prior to that.
Going back to
1948 and prior. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I can't hear very well. Going back to when?
To 1948. And immediately prior to that, to the establishment of the State of Israel, in addressing the issue of terrorism by Zionist groups back then.
Yeah, there's a long record of Zionist terrorism. In this respect, Zionism was no different from other national movements, including the American Revolution, if you want to include that. Yeah, nationalist movements rather typically resort to terrorist acts. And the Zionist movement did as well. The British, by 1947, 46, 47, recognized that they could no longer maintain the Palestinian mandate. Britain was no longer a major force in world affairs. It was, after the Second World War, secondary to the United States. So they wanted to give up the mandate. The question was what to do with it. It went to the United Nations General Assembly, which issued a recommendation that Palestine, the territory from Jordan to the sea, be partitioned into a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. Well, that led to immediate... Palestinians and Arabs generally didn't see any reason to why they should give up half of their country to recent immigrants. And they didn't accept it. That led to civil strife. The British withdrew. There was plenty of terror and violence on both sides. By 1948, Israel, the Jewish community, which then announced the State of Israel in May, had the upper hand from a military point of view, and that continued to be the case with certainly by the end of May. I mean, for about 2 weeks after the establishment of the state in 1948, it was not entirely clear how it was going to turn out from a military point of view, but there was a big shipment of weapons from Czechoslovakia, from the Soviet bloc, to Israel, and that turned the tide, and from June 1948 on, there was no real question as to what the military outcome would be. What it in fact was a partitioning of the Palestinian state, just about 50-50, a partitioning between Israel and Jordan, then called Transjordan. And it was a subject, it was essentially run by the British. And that was with a fair degree of collusion. They essentially agreed to not to fight each other. Jordan had the only professional army in the Arab world run by British officers, but they pretty much stayed out of it. And then the Israel and now Jordan divided the Palestinian state. The part that Israel took over is just called Israel, and nobody questions it. The part that Jordan took over, the other half, is called the West Bank, and that's now a contested territory. In 1967, I'm skipping a ton of history, of course. In 1967, Israel conquered the Egyptian Sinai, the Jordan-held West Bank, and the Syrian Golan Heights, and that's when the current era of diplomacy and conflict really begins. There was an international agreement right away, formulated in UN 242, that Israel should withdraw from the occupied territories with minor and mutual adjustments. The international border was a ceasefire line, and the idea was it should be straightened and improved and so on. Neither Israel nor the Arab states really accepted this, and they sort of gave evasive verbal acceptance, but didn't really accept it. The next step took place, but it was official U.S. policy, minor and mutual adjustments on the international border. Notice there was nothing for the Palestinians. So UN 242, the basic document, doesn't mention Palestinian rights. Now that's why the U.S. always insists on that one, overlooking the fact that it calls for withdrawal, because it doesn't mention the Palestinians. Well, in 1971, the next major step came when Egypt, now ruled by President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty in terms of UN 242, that is, withdrawal from the occupied territories in return for full peace. Again, nothing for the Palestinians. Israel recognized that it was a genuine peace offer. They considered it. They also understood that if they accepted it, it would mean security. With Egypt removed from the conflict, there's no longer any serious international problem. Jordan came along with a similar offer the next year. Israel decided to reject it. They decided to insist upon expansion rather than security. Expansion at that time primarily meant into the Sinai, northeastern Sinai, Egyptian Sinai, where Israel was driving out thousands of peasants, destroying their towns, preparing for building an all-Jewish city, Yamit, and other settlements. Question was what the U.S. would do, which is always decisive. Well, there's an internal debate, and finally Kissinger won out, and the U.S. Supported Israel's rejection of the settlement in a policy that Kissinger called stalemate, his term, meaning no negotiations, just force. Well, that led to the 1973 war, which was a very close thing for Israel, and finally Kissinger recognized they better perceive that Egypt actually just can't be dismissed, then start shuttle diplomacy. And finally, in 1978 and 79, the United States accepted Sadat's 1971 offer. That's the Camp David settlement. However, by that time, what the U.S. accepted in 1978-79 was, from its point of view, harsher than what it rejected in 1971, because by then, the Palestinian issue had reached the international agenda, and Sadat was calling for a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. Well, that was sort of swept under the rug, but Israel did withdraw from the Egyptian Sinai, meanwhile keeping the Gaza, the West Bank, and the Syrian Golan Heights, which it annexed in violation of Security Council orders, by now sort of forgotten. The In 1976, to go back a couple of years, that was the first UN Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement on the international border. Israel reacted to the calling of the session by bombing Lebanon, killing over 50 people in Nabatea. And that was known, like you could read it in the New York Times, but nobody paid any attention to it. That's normal. The U.S. reacted by vetoing the Security Council resolution, as it did again in 1980. And without going through the rest of the history, that's sort of the way it continues. The U.S. has been blocking every diplomatic effort with very slight deviation. I'll go into that if you want. Meanwhile, and the U.S. and Israel, of course, rejects it. But more than just talk, the U.S. and Israel are continuing to carry out settlement and infrastructure programs, which create facts on the ground that undermine the possibility of realization of Palestinian national rights in any meaningful form.
No.
So coming up to today, the current description of these is convergence. That's the Ehud Olmert's term. Convergence, which is described in the United States as courageous withdrawal. In fact, it's a program of annexation, cantonization, and imprisonment. Under this plan, Israel annexes valuable land in the West Bank, the most important resources, namely water, develops infrastructure and settlement programs which break up the shrinking Palestinian areas into three separated cantons, virtually separated from one another, each unviable, all virtually separated from some little corner of Jerusalem that's to be left to Palestinians. It's the center of their commercial, educational, cultural life. And it's all imprisoned because Israel takes over the Jordan Valley.
No, so I wonder if we could try to link the 73 war with the current war, because the 73 war, as you pointed out, was considered a very frightening defeat in many ways. It was certainly looked very bad for the Israeli military for a time. And it's argued, you've pointed out, that the one thing that folks like Henry Kissinger and American planners and the Israeli planners understand, and that's violence, and that once confronted with an effective war-making country, Egypt in that case, they did cede the land. Sinai was given back and a deal was cut. And I'm wondering, what do you see the likely consequences of what appears to be a significant military failure, setback, however we want to describe it, in terms of this latest war in Lebanon?
Well, you're right that that was a very serious threat at that time to Israel. In fact, they were actually concerned about the existence of Israel at that time. But now it's quite different. It was a setback, but it was a setback of aggression. They were not able to carry out the destruction of Hezbollah, despite immense devastation. You know, maybe 1,000 people killed and much of Lebanon destroyed, huge oil spill, which may go all the way as far as Greece and so on. So there's plenty of destruction, but they couldn't achieve their objective. So they will effectively withdraw to Israel, probably maintaining control of part of Lebanon. But notice that's quite different from 1973. There was never a threat to the state of Israel. There were rocket attacks, which were, you know, they in fact are war crimes. They're aiming at civilians, and were harmful, but never threatening a serious security threat to the state. And they were in response to the vast Israeli attack. So what it ends up with is with where it started, with Israel in control of the occupied territories, and now will probably proceed more actively with U.S. support to implement its takeover of the West Bank. In fact, the New York Times, when it wanted an expert to comment on the likely consequences, they of course picked an Israeli professor who said that, well, we'll have to halt our program of withdrawal from the West Bank, meaning the program of annexation, Catanization, and imprisonment. What he meant is, and he of course understands it, is that Israel won't even carry out a partial withdrawal, but will carry out a more aggressive policy in the West Bank, just as it's doing in Gaza. So it's not very much like 1973 in that respect, although it is in one respect, namely the one you mentioned, it was not a military success. Actually, 1973 was more of a military success.
Yeah, this is Per Fagrang. It was alleged that the Hezbollah attacks on villages in northern Israel were, illegal because this is recognized Israeli territory. What if rockets were to attack some of these Jewish settlements in the West Bank, which are plainly illegal? I mean, what happens then?
To attacks in the West Bank on
right.
Jewish settlers?
I mean,
you have to decide on your standards.
Mm-hmm.
According to the United States and Israel, any resistance, in fact, any deterrent to U.S.-Israeli actions is illegitimate. The rest of the world may not agree with that. Much of the world does agree that resistance to military occupation, takeover of land and resources, is legitimate. And notice that if it's legitimate in the West Bank, and it would be interesting to see an argument to the contrary, if it's legitimate in the West Bank, it's also legitimate in Gaza. Because the West Bank and Gaza are regarded, recognized by everyone, including the U.S. and Israel, to be a single unit.
Do you think Israel still has gearing up for a war with Iran? Do they want that? Because I just read a thing very recently that Rafi Eitan is now saying that that Iran actually wants Israel to attack to provide an excuse to attack Israel. Now, this is kind of a delusion. This is really a weird statement on his part, but it
who
didn't...
is this?
Rafi Eitan. He's in the cabinet, and I think he's a former Mossad chief.
Well,
it indicates to me that this is sort of a backing away, at least on his part, from a possible war with Iran.
Well, we don't know what U.S. and Israeli planners are doing. They keep that a secret, like most governments. So again, we're speculating. But my speculation is that they will not attack Iran. It would be a pretty crazy thing to do. It's pretty clear that the U.S. military and U.S. intelligence are opposed, probably pretty strongly opposed. The rest of the world is almost certainly opposed. In the region itself, the neighboring countries, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, which don't like Iran one bit, far from it. And nevertheless, the populations in those countries, according to recent international polls, the populations of those countries prefer a nuclear-armed Iran, which is a real threat to them, prefer that to any military action. In fact, any military action that's undertaken will be in the face of enormous opposition, even from within the U.S. military and intelligence, probably. They'll do what they're told, but they don't approve of it. And it could be extremely hazardous, even for the interests of the Bush administration, let alone the victims. Nobody knows what would happen. It could blow up Iraq, for example. My guess is they won't do it. They probably want to, I think, it's a pure guess. My guess is that the threats against Iran, and notice that those threats are themselves grave violations of international law. Nobody cares about that. Those threats, I suspect, are intended to make the government of Iran harsher, to lead it to harsher actions. That's the usual response to the threat of attack. And that may increase dissension and dissatisfaction within Iran and contribute to ongoing programs, which almost certainly are underway, of subversion internal to Iran and probably support for secessionist movements in Iran, which might just weaken the government. In fact, Iranian Democrats are bitterly condemning the U.S. threats and sanctions. Iranian reformers because they expect them to have, and they are having exactly this effect. I just talked to one of the leading ones a few days ago, Akbar Ganji, who has been emphasizing that in talks around the United States and emphasized it again in our private conversation. But that's a general view of Iranian dissidents and democratic reformers. But the Bush administration wants the opposite. They want the government to become more harsh and create more dissension and maybe help contribute to subversion. Actually, there is a real issue. The real nobody in their right mind wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. But there are ways to approach that diplomatically. In 2003, the Iranian government, then the moderate Khatami government, offered to negotiate all issues, nuclear issues, two-state settlement for Israel-Palestine, every issue on the table. They offered to negotiate it. The Bush administration didn't reject it. They simply dismissed it and censured the Swiss diplomat who brought the offer. And similar offers continue, right up to today. I mean, the West delights in the outrageous statements of President Ahmadinejad, but it's kept quiet. An important fact is kept quiet. He has a superior, what they call the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And Khamenei, has reiterated his support for Iran's support for the Arab League position on Israel-Palestine, which means a two-state settlement with full normalization of relations with Israel that's supported by Iran as well at the highest level, the most extremist clerics, and has also reiterated the call for negotiations. Now, the version here is that the U.S. has become more forthcoming about negotiations. It's now willing to enter in negotiations, which is technically true, but if you look at the conditions, it's meaningless. The U.S. insists that prior to negotiations, Iran must concede what the U.S. wants to be the conclusion of the negotiations. So Iran must first terminate its programs of uranium enrichment, which everyone agrees are its legal right, as a precondition for negotiations. Now, that's supposed to be the outcome of negotiations, but Condoleezza Rice insists that has to be the precondition. Furthermore, Iran is supposed to enter into negotiations with a gun to its head. The U.S. refuses flatly to withdraw the threats of attack. Well, negotiations under those conditions are not serious, of course. But negotiations are possible, and there could be a positive outcome.
Noam, you're absolutely right about no one wanting Iran to have nuclear weapons. However, there's been no pressure on Israel to give up its nuclear capability.
Well, there's plenty of pressure. It's just not coming from the U.S. government. The world, the countries of the region, Iraq, Iran, all the countries of the region have been calling for years for a nuclear-free Middle East. In fact, there are the international agreements that the U.S. has technically approved of call for a nuclear-free Middle East. That's what everyone wants. The U.S., former head of the U.S. Strategic Command, General Lee Butler, that's the top agency concerned with nuclear weapons, has warned that Israel's nuclear weapons constitute a very serious danger to the whole region and are an intolerable threat. It's the civilians in Washington who refuse this. They refuse. And that's Clinton just as much as Bush, in fact, goes way back, refused to accept the global, the almost unanimous worldwide effort, including in the region, to denuclearize the whole region. Well, that would be one way to solve the problem of Iranian nuclear weapons. Now, there are other ways. It's not reported here, but there are important facts, as important as Iran's formal declaration of support for a two-state settlement and normalization of relations with Israel. As important as that is an issue that's broader than Iranian nuclear weapons. It has to do with production of weapons usable fissile materials. I mean, if there is no barrier to production of such materials, the world's going to blow up. I mean, almost every strategic analyst is familiar with this likelihood and warning about it constantly. Well, there are proposals as to how to deal with it. The most important one, one of the most important ones, was made by Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Agency, Energy Agency, a couple of years ago. He proposed that all weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium be placed under international control, and any country that wants to use enriched uranium for peaceful purposes should apply to this international agency, and if their proposals are acceptable, they'll be granted access. Well, that would end a much larger crisis than the Iranian nuclear crisis. To this day, as far as I'm aware, there's only one country that's accepted that offer, namely Iran. That's pretty important, but you won't find it reported here. And that offers another way to settle this crisis, and in fact a much broader crisis. Now, of course, we don't know for certain that the Iranian offers are serious. We don't know that they really mean their formal declaration that they accept the two-state settlement and normalization of relations with Israel. We don't know that they mean to grant an international agency control over production of all fissile materials and to stop it themselves. But we can't. There's only one way to find out, and that's to explore their proposals through negotiations. And that's exactly what the U.S. doesn't want to do. And I should add, the media don't want it either. That's why these things are never reported. And these are very important statements and declarations. To conceal them is very dangerous to us.
You're tuned to KBOO Community Radio, and you're listening to a special feature program focused on the Middle East. Our guest right now is Professor Noam Chomsky. Professor Chomsky, we've already imposed about 10 minutes over our time limit. Would you like to stay a little longer, or do you have to run off to yet another interview today?
I got another interview, but let's try 10 more minutes.
Okay. Then I wonder if you could talk. This is a little bit of a change, but it's a question trying to get at the evolution of U.S. foreign policy in recent years. A number of years back, you were one of the few people who had talked about the issue of peak oil as a potential factor influencing U.S. foreign policy planners. And I'm wondering if you think that that continues to play a role, and if so, to what degree?
Well, actually, I personally haven't emphasized the issue of peak oil. Undoubtedly, the question is real. I mean, oil is a finite resource, and sooner or later, production will peak. As to when it will peak, there's considerable debate, and in fact, it's partly a matter of definition. The more one is willing to pay for it, the later the date of the peak, because, you know, there are expensive forms of oil, like tar sands and so on, that are more expensive to extract, but gives a much later date for the peak. The energy corporations are the ones with the most of the data on this, and there's no particular reason to think that they're telling us what they know. But the most conservative of them about peak oil has been ExxonMobil, biggest of them, which in its recent projection, 25-year projection, estimated that within about 10 years, non-OPEC oil would peak. OPEC has, meaning mainly the Middle East, has very large reserves still, and that would be later, maybe a couple decades later. And this, they conclude, ExxonMobil, that the expensive forms of oil extraction, like tar sands in Canada and Venezuelan heavy oil, which is vast, they conclude that that's just too expensive. But of course, that's a, you know, that's an economic decision, not a decision having to do with availability of oil. Well, maybe that's right, maybe it's not right. However, there's something to bear in mind about this. If the date of peak oil, you know, the timing of peak oil is closer, that may be a benefit. The use of hydrocarbons is more dangerous in the long term than their lack of availability. If an impending peak oil crisis is closer than anticipated, that could drive, should drive the United States mainly, but also other countries, to actions that they ought to be undertaking anyway, namely serious efforts at conservation, which would probably be good for the economy and certainly good for the environment, and search for a kind of sustainable economy and lifestyle which isn't going to destroy the environment for future generations. Now, that's a very serious problem. And we can put it off and say, okay, we'll let our grandchildren worry about it. But the longer one delays, countries delay in dealing with this problem, which is very real, the longer they delay, the worse it's going to be. And it could be catastrophic. In fact, alongside of the threat of nuclear war, it's, which is serious, that's the most serious threat that the species faces, literally the species. It could be a matter of species destruction. So peak oil has many dimensions to it that have to be considered. I doubt, frankly, that peak oil is much of a concern in the current, either in the invasion of Iraq or the current affairs in Lebanon and Palestine. I mean, surely the U.S. wants to maintain control of the major energy resources of the world, and that, which is the primary reason for invading Iraq, almost certainly. And that's independent of what the date for peak oil is estimated to be.
Well, do you think that the U.S. and Israel have the idea of getting Iraqi oil through existing pipelines as one that goes from northern Iraq to Israel, which is, I guess, not being used right now, and then there's this new pipeline that opened up to Turkey. Is Israel trying to secure its oil future, at least for a while, or is that what's behind this war?
Probably that's a consideration, but a pretty minor one. I mean, once oil is produced and begins to be distributed, it's basically, it's not directed to particular places. It can go anywhere. Israel doesn't face, as long as Israel is a protectorate of the United States, it doesn't face a serious oil crisis any more than anyone else does. It probably faces a more serious water crisis than oil crisis in the near future. The U.S. certainly wants to. There is no doubt that the U.S. is trying very hard, quite apart from Israel, to ensure that the pipelines from Central Asia, particularly, are under the control of the United States. There's a real international conflict going on about Central Asian resources, oil included, and also, right in the background, Middle East resources. If you look at the pipeline debate, the U.S. just opened a pipeline, in fact, that goes from Azerbaijan, another major, fairly significant producer, ends up in Turkey, and carefully skirts Iran and Russia, and goes through countries that the U.S. thinks it can control, even though that's not at all the most economical route, just as a matter of controlling what happens in to Central Asian resources. But the U.S. isn't in this game by itself. China and Russia are, especially China, are the basis for an Asian energy security grid, as it's called, and also the Shanghai Cooperation Council, a similar organization, which unites the major economies of Asia and, in fact, Central Asia. Their Central Asian dictatorships are also part of it. And they are trying to seek energy independence, independent of the United States. And Russia has plenty of resources, and China is considered a serious threat in the United States, not because it's a military threat, but because it can't be intimidated.
Noam, this is Hala again. If I could shift gears a little bit, something that has concerned me for many years here in the U.S. is the progressive community's lack of or failure to address the Palestinian suffering and Palestinian issue. Can you talk to us about why that is so?
Now, that's a shocking failure. It's one of the most disgraceful aspects of contemporary American intellectual and moral culture, and you're certainly right about the progressive community. It's avoided it. Partly, I think, it's out of ignorance. The truth of the matter is simply suppressed. For example, everything I was saying before in this brief run through the history, almost nobody knows. You can't even find it in most scholarship. You have to either read dissident literature or do your own research. People don't have time for that. Another is since 1967, Israel performed a major service to the United States and to the energy corporations and to Saudi Arabia. Namely, it destroyed secular Arab nationalism, which was Nasser, which was considered a serious threat because it was threatening to use the energy resources of the region for the benefit of the people of the region, not for export, for enriching the West and the few dictators who line their pockets and become indescribably wealthy. And that was considered a threat. Well, Israel ended that threat. It's worth recalling that the U.S. has been a very strong supporter of fundamentalist Islamic extremism since the Second World War. It still is. One of its most valued and oldest Middle East ally is Saudi Arabia, which makes Iran look like a democratic heaven. And Israel has too. They have preferred constantly radical Islamists to secular nationalists. That's in fact the source of Hamas and Hezbollah as well. But Israel did succeed in destroying the main center of secular Arab nationalism in 67. That's when the U.S.-Israeli alliance was really firmed up. It was a great service, not only to the U.S., but also, as I mentioned, to Saudi Arabia, which the Saudi Arabian ruler's ruling tyranny was threatened by secular nationalism. In fact, Saudi Arabia and Egypt were at war at the time. Well, Israel ended all of that. Shortly after that, the U.S. intellectual classes entered into what can only be called a love affair with Israel. They greatly admired its success in violence, its crushing third world people, its providing services to the United States. Of course, all this was dressed in a different garb. It was called, concern to preserve the only Middle East democracy from destruction. The Holocaust, which had been a horror story, obviously, had been pretty much ignored before that. I mean, it was even ignored when it was possible to save the victims in the late 1940s. There were still plenty of victims suffering. They're not here. It became a huge issue after 67. This is a real, it's a real profound insult to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust to use their hideous fate as a device for justifying the repression of others. But that's actually what's happened. I mean, it's since 1967 that there has to be a Holocaust museum in every town, and if anyone criticizes Israel, you scream Holocaust, and so on. It wasn't true before. And it had to do mostly with justifying the U.S.-Israeli takeover of the occupied territories and rejection of a diplomatic settlement. But that's the, that's the core of the intellectual culture, the moral intellectual culture. It's all the people here. You don't read anything else. So, for example, this morning's newspaper happens to quote one of the moderates in the who has been in and out of government, Edward Walker, is now president of the Middle East Policy Institute, and he is by U.S. standards. Kind of a moderate, dovish figure. He describes U.S. policy pre-Bush as being a neutral honest broker trying to achieve peace. He says, well, Bush is a bad guy. He kind of departed from this. And that is radically different from the history. But you're not going to hear a word of criticism about it.
No, we're coming up on the end of our hour, and we have so completely imposed on you by going far beyond the half hour you had originally agreed to. I want to let you get back to your other commitments there, and thank you very much for joining us today. Hopefully we'll have you back sometime soon.
Hope so. Thank you.
And that was Institute Emeritus Professor of Linguistics at MIT, Noam Chomsky. And if you want to read more about the topics that he was just now discussing, and there's plenty more to read about in terms of that history, recently republished is his initial collection of essays, Peace in the Middle East. It's been republished as Middle East Illusions. And, of course, his other books on this topic, The Fateful Triangle, and his latest book, which I think all of us can recommend very highly, Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. That book is also available as an audiobook, so you can listen to it during your commute or while you're exercising. You can become better informed about all of these issues in that way.